Yesterday we looked at the reign of Julian, the apostate, and we saw this great effort to overthrow Christianity and how it did not last very long, came to a tragic end, but for a time it's made real difficulty. And then we went on to look at G, the downfall of Arianism. Under that we took number one, the reign of Valens, 364 to 378. And under that, small a, was the reign of Jovian, which we looked at briefly. We noticed that Athanasius went to the east away to see Jovian, was received with great favor by Jovian. But Jovian didn't live long. Then he was succeeded by Valens, small b, the accession of Valens. And Valens stood definitely with the Arians, but he had a rather difficult situation to get the things reorganized, and he could not be as effective in this as he would like to have been. Constantius inherited a control from his father that was very thoroughly established. Valens did not have so secure a throne as this, and he was occupied with other things much more than Constantius had had to be. So he was not nearly as effective, and furthermore, a number of strong opponents of Arianism had grown up and were coming into prominence by this time. So we notice small c, the efforts of Valens to carry out the policy of Constantius. The efforts of Valens to carry out the policy of Constantius. Valens, very soon after he became emperor, gave orders, very cleverly, that all the bishops whom Julian had brought back from exile should be sent into exile again. And now this was very clever, because Julian, in his antagonism to Christianity, had given the order to bring back the bishops whom Constantius had sent into exile, thinking this would set the Christians at variance with one another and would weaken Christianity. But these men were on the whole so much more able, so much more capable than the ones whom Constantius had put in, that it had just the other effect from what Julian wanted. But now, Valens, who comes in and is a Christian, so an Arian, takes advantage of this by saying all the bishops whom Constantius had exiled and Julian had brought back, all of them are to be again sent into exile. And so they said this means that Athanasius must again be sent into exile. Well, people tried to argue. Julian, well, it's true he brought him back. He didn't keep him there long. He sent him into exile too. And so he should not come under this category. But Athanasius did have to suffer for a brief time. He was sent into exile. But the Valens found that the people of Egypt as a whole were so devoted to Athanasius for his excellent administration, for his many philanthropies, for his fine character, that it was much harder to keep Egypt in a decent condition and get the taxes and the support and help for the realm without Athanasius than it was with him. And he found that for the safety of the realm, it was necessary to forego his own personal preference in this matter. And so he then let Athanasius come back. And for his last years, Athanasius was not bothered. So we go on to number two. Number two, the last years of Athanasius. The last years of Athanasius. Here we might just briefly summarize again what Athanasius went through in his long life of struggle. Well, it was a long life of struggle against Arianism. And I think we have to say that fully a third of Athanasius' activity and energy had to go into this struggle. But we must never forget that Athanasius also had done a tremendous amount to advance Christianity, a tremendous amount to administer the church wisely in Alexandria and in Egypt as a whole, that his influence and his activity, apart from his great controversy against Arianism, had been a very salutary thing during this fourth century. It also might be good at this point just to briefly review the sufferings and difficulties that Athanasius went through. Now, there's no use if you're trying to get on the precise dates of his exile and of all the details about it, but I want to run over it simply to give you a vivid idea of just what Athanasius did go through. Some think it was 326 when he became bishop. Some say 328. There was a little there's a little disagreement as to the precise date when he became bishop. But he was bishop until 336 as a young man in his early 30s, administering over many men 20, 30 years older than himself and doing it very wisely, very excellently. But it was a year before the death of Constantine that he was sent into exile. And some say this was because Constantine thought that he'd held back the green ship. Others say that Constantine's own son said Constantine did it to protect him because he saw the great strength of his enemies. We can't prove what was in Constantine's mind. But it probably was a good thing for Athanasius, this particular exile. After having been busied for somewhere between 8 and 10 years in the very busy administration of the work in Alexandria, to have about a year to a year and a half of more or less idleness in a great city many miles away, a distance that would take probably 2 or 3 weeks of hard travel in those days, in entirely different surroundings, with a governor who was friendly to him and a bishop who was friendly to him, it gave him a chance perhaps to deepen his spiritual life, to meditate on things that was hard to find the time for in his busy work there. And so this first exile, while it was a real vexation to him, was probably actually a good thing for him. But then, when the sons of Constantine came to the throne, remember Constantius was in power in the eastern area, which included Egypt. But the other two sons were friendly to Athanasius. And it was through their friendship that Athanasius was brought back to immediately, and Constantius, under the circumstances, felt it wise to show a friendly attitude to Athanasius, greeted him in most friendly fashion, and was hoping to make a friend of him. But Athanasius then came back in 339, he came back to Alexandria, and began again his work there in the city. But immediately his enemy, who had been after him so hard during the previous 5 years, really because of their Arianism, but hiding it under all sorts of excuses and claims such as the one that they said he murdered Arsenius and these other criticisms, they now said that he had been condemned by the council at Tyre, and that therefore he could not come back until a council had restored him, that the emperors could not do it. And they, the very ones who had been trying to get the emperors to send him into exile. But they raised all these matters and sent complaints to Rome to try to get the bishop of the largest city in the empire to take a stand against Athanasius. And well, things got to the point where Athanasius thought it wise to go to Rome himself and present his cause there, and they took over control of Egypt and put in an Arian bishop who proved to be a cruel and very inefficient man, and who was soon very greatly hated by most everybody in Alexandria. But he had a number of years in Rome then. And then, you remember that that when Constance urged Constantius to let him come back, then he Constantius again greeted him with great friendliness and asked him to administer Egypt in such a way that it would be a real help to the empire. And he then had nearly 9 years as bishop undisturbed in the middle part of Constantius' reign. And during this time, he did very excellent work there, and he also wrote extensively against the Arians. But then you remember in 350, a general rose up against Constans and killed him, and for 3 years ruled in the West. And this general sent to try to get Athanasius' friendship. Athanasius kept out of it altogether, but he was accused of having made friends with this usurper. Constantius fought against him, and Constantius' troops were victorious, and by 353, Magnentius was killed, and Constantius now had the whole empire in his hands. And after that, Athanasius, who had been back for, by this time, about 7 to 8 years, Athanasius wondered, now that Constantius had everything in his power, what would he do? Constantius had been having councils of bishops, trying to get a council that would supplant the Council of Nicaea, one that would be recognized as a general council, one that would do away with the Nicene Creed. He'd been very active in these lines, and now he had the whole empire under his hand. And at one meeting where the bishops were discussing something and trying to make a decision, Constantius said, well, I think I will order such and such. And the bishop said, oh, you can't do that. This is a matter bishops have to decide. This is a matter for a canon of the church. And Constantius said, what I want, that's what any canon is to be. And it showed the attitude that he had toward the church. And so when these stories came to Constantinople, Athanasius wondered how much longer he would last there. And then a new governor was sent, and a friend of Athanasius asked this governor if he had any orders regarding Athanasius, and he said, no, absolutely not. And he hid his true orders. Until one night when they had thousands of people gathered in a great church, and of course they didn't have electric lighting in those days, but they were having an all-night service in preparation for the communion service the next day. And in the middle of the service, the governor with 5,000 troops surrounded the church. And they had come to suddenly seize Athanasius. And they began coming into the church to try to get Athanasius, and all the lights, the candles were dashed out, and there was considerable disturbance, and quite a few people were trampled to death, and Athanasius himself fainted, but some other members of the clergy were able to carry him out and get out with between the groups of soldiers, and they got him away. And so this time he escaped with his life, and this time he fled to the desert. And there in the desert there were now groups of hermits here and there. And Athanasius spent the next 4 years going from one group to another of these hermits. And among these hermits, he would stay with a group, and then they would get word that troops were getting into the neighborhood, and he would at night move from them to another group. And he was constantly moving, but constantly writing, sending letters to the church, and exerting a great influence even in this period of exile. Then after the death of Constantius, Athanasius came back, of course, and he was well treated by Jovian, but Jovian didn't live very long, and Valens, as we noticed, sent him off into his last exile, which only lasted a few months before Valens found that it was the wise thing to permit him to come back. So there were five different times he was sent into exile, and altogether, out of the 46 years he was bishop, 20 of them, he was in exile. But during his time of exile, he was still very active. And with Athanasius, we have not only his great ability, his wonderful character, his tremendous Christian influence, but we have a great wisdom as to where to take his stand. The great issue at Nicaea had been that Christ is of the same substance as the Father. And there were many people now who thought that's a new phrase. It's not in the Bible anywhere, that word homoousia. It's not in the Bible. It's not been used in 300 years of Christian history, except once in a while you find it in the writings of a heretic in some connection which is quite different from the way we're using it now. They wanted to keep away from the use of the word. Well, Athanasius was quite convinced that this word was the best word they could find for the purpose, but he did not, simply because somebody refused to use the word, immediately decide that person was an Arian. He was very careful to survey a man's works, his writing, and his attitude. And he made friends with some men who had great disinclination to the word, but who in their beliefs were very definitely on the Nicene side. And in many cases, he persuaded them to give up their objections to the word. And thus, he had great discernment in winning to him many who really were much nearer him than to Constantius, but who had, from one motive or another, been swung in Constantius' direction. There was a man named Apollinaris, whom we will mention later, A-P-O-L-L-I-N-A-R-S. Apollinaris, who during the reign of Julian, when Julian said, Christians must not teach the classics. And the question was, how will our Christian young people get a solid training if they can't study the classics, which were the basis of all training in those days, as they were in this country up till about 40 years ago. How can our children get a sound training without studying the classics, and Christians weren't allowed to teach them? Well, Apollinaris set to work to write some new classics that would be Christian classics. And it was something that a man can't just set to work to do. It takes great ability to write works that are really classic, and yet the effort to do it was productive of good, and it showed a determination to advance Christianity in every reasonable way, and probably stimulated others to do better things than Apollinaris did in the end, who might not have if he had not set the way. Well, naturally, Athanasius felt very friendly toward his friend Apollinaris. But now Apollinaris, in trying to explain the relation of God, the second person of the Trinity, to the man, Christ Jesus, invented a new theory which he thought solved all the problems. And it didn't at all. It made the problems much worse. But he thought it solved them. We'll look at this later on. I only mention at this point that Athanasius found it necessary to write very strongly against this harmful theory that Apollinaris presented. But he never mentioned Apollinaris in his writing. He tried to distinguish between the good man who had fallen into this error and the harmful error in which Apollinaris was propagating. It is an error which we will look at later. It's not so important for itself as for a group of errors that it originated, that followed in line after it. But Athanasius dealt then with another problem, that of the matter of the division in the Godhead. After all, there's one God. There's not three gods, there's one God. We must agree to that. Jesus Christ and God the Father and God the Holy Spirit, they are one God, not three gods. One God from all eternity. He is of the same substance as the Father, and yet they're not just manifestations. That would be Sabellianism. They are not just manifestations. Well, then, what are we to call that? Well, Athanasius and others, after much discussion, hit upon a Greek word, hypostasis. And this Greek word, hypostasis, was the word which they came to adopt in Greek. And most theologians agree that this Greek word is a very good word to express the idea, the separate hypostasis, though the one God, the one nature. The word hypostasis had been used for substance by some before, so it took quite a change of terminology. But Athanasius and others figured out this was the best way to deal with this phase of the problem. Now, in Latin, this word hypostasis was translated by persona, which all agree is a much poorer word to express. In Latin, persona meant a mask that an actor wore when he represented different characters. And you see, that's getting in the direction of Sabellianism. Now, in English, we go in the opposite direction. When we speak of two different persons, we'd never say, if you had two persons here, that they were one man. You couldn't possibly say that. But that's what it amounts to say we have three persons, but one God. Because the word person, as we use it in English, is not a good term. Unfortunately, we don't know of a better term. And the word hypostasis has never been introduced into English form. So we use the word person, but we want to realize that we don't mean what we would mean when we speak of two persons who could hardly be just one man. Here we have two hypostasis. We call it two persons who are one God. There is a distinction. God the Father is in a very special sense God. He is the Father, the great original. You can't say original because there was no time when God the Son, God the Holy Spirit did not exist. It's a mystery we don't understand. It may be that, as like so many things in our world today, that anybody 100 years ago couldn't possibly have understood, are perfectly simple to us now that we've discovered new principles or new factors that were unknown then. It may be that there are simple factors which we will be explained to us in heaven, which will make it easy for us to see how this can be. On the other hand, it may be a mystery which will be beyond human understanding through all eternity. But it is a fact. It is a fact taught in the Scripture and definitely held by all true Christians, I would say, at least by all who thought it through carefully, that there is only one God, but there are three hypostasis, or persons, as we rather ineptly say, in English. But this problem of terminology was one which Athanasius and Fred worked over, and I wish they could have done as good a job for Latin and English as they seem to have done for the Greek. Now, Athanasius did not live to see the triumph of his ideas, but he saw them greatly improving in their influence, being more widely accepted, and he died like Moses before the promised land was actually entered, but he saw it from afar. I would like to read to you a couple of words from Shaw's statement about Athanasius as a writer. He says, as an author, Athanasius is distinguished for theological depth and discrimination, for dialectical skill, and sometimes for culminating eloquence. He everywhere evinces a triumphant intellectual superiority over his antagonists. He pursues them into all their hiding places and refutes all their arguments and their sophisms, but never loses sight of the main point of the controversy, to which he ever returns with renewed force. His views are governed by a strict logical connection, but his stormy fortune prevented him from composing a large systematic work. Almost all his writings are occasional, that is, things that were due to particular situations, wrung from him by circumstance. Not a few of them were written in exile. Of course, his festal letters, which he sent out every year, as ordered by the Council of Nicaea, to tell the whole Christian world when Easter would be, were not simply a statement of the date of Easter, but they contained also devotional discussion or a discussion about some Christian truth. They were very beneficial to the whole Christian world, but nobody thought of keeping them. Probably everybody put them up in all the churches and read them and said, isn't this wonderful? And then a year later, they tear down the old one. It might get into the wastebasket. Maybe it disappeared long before the year was up. And so 150 years ago, it was thought that his festal letters had disappeared. And then there was discovered in the East a Syriac translation of quite a number of these letters. And so we have this translation of his festal letters, one of which is of great importance for the study of the canon of the New Testament, and all of which are of interest as showing his great devotional heart and his great Christian attitude. Well, I want now to speak briefly of a few of the great men who helped in the downfall of Arianism. Yes? No, that was a little later. Yes. The phrase homoousia, which was suggested at the council, shocked the area. They said he couldn't be the same substance. He's an altogether different substance. Then, after the Arians had been sent into exile, others later tried to make a compromise by saying he's not of the same substance, he's of a similar substance. Well, some call that semi-Arian. But the fact is, I believe that most of the real Arians felt that it was far enough to fit what they were trying to say. And the big struggle was between homoiousia and homoousia, but that didn't come up right in the council. It was a little later. Naturally, there are so many things here that we could spend a year on the life of Athanasius, but I can just try to give the main features of it.
Yes.
I'm not sure whether it's proof just when that phrase originated, but it certainly was typical of Athanasius through the years when he was in exile, fleeing, hiding in the desert, and people said, everything is, what's the use of your standing up? Why don't you join in? The whole world is going Arian. And he said, well, if the world goes Arian, it'll be Athanasius against the world. Now, whether he actually said it to any emperor, I don't know. And I'm not sure there could be proof, because most of the writings about him come from some time later, and even if it was something happened 10 years ago, it'd be hard to prove now. But the phrase did come into use, so that Athanasius against the world is a phrase people used to use not long after the death of Athanasius, at least, to describe. I was hoping to assign you one of the writings of Athanasius to read, but I find we only have one copy in the library, and that is a little too few for so many here. Then I found by Gregory Nazianzen a very nice oration given in Constantinople in honor of Athanasius, and again, we have only one copy, so I won't be able to assign that to you. There, I have to make my assignment matters that we can have sufficient copies to get around it. Our next assignment, therefore, I used one work for which we have only three copies, but one that we have four copies and one we have six copies. Now, the one that we have six copies of is one that deals with something we won't come to for another 2 or 3 weeks, but it's something I'd like to do a lot of reading about, and we have the six copies, so I'm going to make that one of the assignments. I'm dividing the class in three parts, and so that you can use these 7, 13 books all at the same time. I'm not sure whether Mrs. Geibel's in this morning. If she is, they'll be put on the reserve shelf now, and I'll post the time to meet her. If not, I'd better wait and post it tomorrow. But I will also post the list of the third of the class that has each one now, but this will be our last assignment of any length this semester, and they will be spaced out through the rest of the semester. In view of the fact there being only three for one of the assignments, I will try to be quite lenient if they're a little late, but try to get in as early as you can so as not to have a rush on the books at the last minute. But I don't want any of them more than a week late, unless you're actually sitting back. And I don't want any of them after the beginning of the exam period, of course. Now, I want to mention then a few of these other men, but I won't say much about them, although some of them we could say a great deal about. I think in the length of the course we will have to, better to take a few men like Athanasius and really know a good deal about them than to know a fair amount about much larger numbers. But we must mention number three, Hilaire of Poitiers. Number three, Hilaire, H-I-L-A-R-Y. Hilaire of Poitiers, P-O-I-T-I-E-R-S. There's very little of the drama in the life of this man, perhaps because he lived in France, which was most of the period under the control of emperors who were favorable to the Nicene Creed. But Hilaire was the man who in the West did more to advance the Nicene Creed than anyone else in the West. He is not as great a man as Athanasius at all, but he is the greatest man in the West at this period in that particular direction. And he was sent into exile for a period when Constantius controlled the West, and during this exile, he wrote 12 books on the Trinity. He seems to have been a man of thorough biblical knowledge, theological depth, and earnest, efficient piety. It is, we will not say much about him, just want you to know that there was one man in the West. It wasn't one of the bishops of Rome. The bishops of Rome stood for the truth during this period. One of them we saw signed an Arian priest, but he did it from cowardice and fear, not from belief. But there was no bishop of Rome as yet who was an outstanding figure. But this man from France was an outstanding figure, Hilary of Poitiers. We will have to, however, content ourselves with just that little bit about him at this point. He was a bishop of the town of Poitiers. Then number four is Basil the Great. Here is a man in the West who has been thought of sufficient importance to call him Basil the Great. He was a man from Asia Minor, a brilliant young man who went to Athens to study and studied there at the same period when Julian the Apostate was there. And he studied under a great rhetorician named Libanius in Athens, perhaps the greatest heathen teacher of the day. He studied rhetoric, mathematics, and philosophy with him and with his intimate friend, whom we'll mention next, Gregory Nazianzen, and the Prince Julian the Apostate was in the class of two. And when Libanius was on his deathbed, people said, "Who can succeed you as a great teacher and authority on rhetoric, mathematics, and philosophy?" He said, "It would be Basil if only the Christians hadn't taken him away." And it's a pretty good evidence of how great he considered Basil's ability to be. Well, Basil, he came from a Christian family of several generations. And he had a very fine Christian training and also the best education of the time. He was a very able man, a good writer, but he is outstanding for his work of organization. And when he was in control here as bishop in the northern Cappadocia and with authority over the bishops of quite an area there, the emperor Basil thought he had better ban the emperor of Valens thought he had better banish Basil. But the two men, he was bishop of Caesarea in Cappadocia, Caesarea and in Cappadocia. And Valens wanted to bring Cappadocia under control of Arianism, and he threatened Basil with confiscation, banishment, and death. And Basil said nothing more. He said, "Not one of these things touches me." He said, "My property can't be forfeited because I haven't any. Banishment I know not, for I'm restricted to no place, and I'm the guest of God to whom the whole earth belongs. For martyrdom I'm unfit, but death is a benefactor to me, for it sends me more quickly to God, to whom I live and move." And the emperor did not banish him, and there is considerable confusion as to why it was that he didn't. It may have been that, as in the case of Athanasius in Egypt, that he saw how much Basil meant for the general well-being of the province. And in the situation which the empire was in at that time, it was necessary for him to put the security of the empire ahead of his own desire to make his theological ideas dominant. There was one later writer in the Greek who went so far in his praise of Basil's writing as to say that if you want to become a great rhetorician, you don't need to study Demosthenes or Cicero, but Basil is quite sufficient. That probably is extreme, but it shows that he He was a good writer, but he was such an organizer, such a leader, such a shepherd of souls and church ruler, that it's primarily for that that he is remembered. Just about 3 miles northeast of here, I happened to notice one day a big building which was, I don't know whether it's a Greek Orthodox place, but it says on it, the Monastery of Basil, of St. Basil the Great. And so his name is preserved right in this area. He was, being in the east, he was much more remembered in the east than in the west. But he has been honored by the whole church. He died the latter part of the 70s, shortly before 380. And the end of Arianism comes in 381. We haven't quite come to that yet. But next I want to mention Gregory of Nazianzum. Gregory Nazianzum, this in his case is perhaps the town where he was born, where his father was bishop. Gregory, Nazianzum. Gregory Nazianzum. Gregory came from another very fine Christian family. His father was a bishop. He was trained in Athens, was in classes with Basil, and became a very close friend of Basil. And he was a great orator, very fine speaker, and a good student, was anxious to devote himself to studies, but the time when he came nearest to having a break with Basil was when Basil felt it very important that the Orthodox people have a bishop in a certain area, and there was a little tiny town, a very insignificant place where two roads came together, which he decided to make Gregory the bishop of. Little place hardly worth mentioning called Sasima, S-A-S-I-M-A. And Gregory had no desire to go to this little tiny place. It's uncertain he ever did go to it. But Basil prevailed on him to submit to their making him the bishop of this little tiny place. But Gregory continued with his writing and with his work, and he went into Constantinople about 379. And Constantinople, this was right after the death of Valens, when the new emperor, who was friendly to the Orthodox people, had no time to give to the religious matters, trying to reestablish things after the great defeat in battle where Valens was killed. Gregory went into Constantinople, where under the influence of Constantius and Valens, all the preaching had been Arian. All the churches were in the hands of the Arians, and he found a little group of people holding to the Orthodox faith who had been meeting in a little place, and he went in and began to preach to them, and preached to a handful of people, and he gave a series of sermons on the deity of Christ, which were so wonderfully stated and so wonderfully delivered that soon he had great crowds coming to hear it. And he made a tremendous change in the whole attitude of Constantinople, which had been thoroughly under the domination of the Arians. And so Gregory did a great work in preparing the way for the end of Arianism there in Constantinople, and also a great work in presenting the gospel and enriching the Christian lives of these people in Constantinople. We'll say a little more of him in connection with the council. But before we do that, we mention number six. Number six, Gregory of Nyssa, N-Y-S-S-A. Gregory of Nyssa was a younger brother of Basil. He was a younger brother of Basil, a very acute theological thinker. And his writing, he wrote very extensively. And he was asked once by a Cappadocian abbot about a pilgrimage of monks to Jerusalem. He said, "Change of place brings us no nearer to God, but where thou art, God can come to thee." if only the inn of thy soul is ready. It is better to go out of the body and raise oneself to the Lord than to leave Cappadocia to journey to Palestine. He was largely active as a writer. He was more a man of thought than of action. He did lasting service through his careful thinking and clear expression in his discussions of the Trinity and of the Incarnation. Number 7, the elevation of Saint Ambrose in Berlin, in Milan. Ambrose in Milan. Now we should say a little more about Ambrose later. He's one of the great figures of this period. But we're talking now about the downfall of Arianism, in which he played a substantial part. And so I want to mention at this point, Ambrose was a Roman from a Christian family in Rome. And he had gone into political life, and he was sent from Rome to be the governor of Milan. Milan, as you know, is the greatest industrial city in northern Italy. And when it was at some time, period, even the capital of the Roman Empire. Well, Ambrose, when he left Rome, the governor of the whole of Italy said to him, he said, go to Milan, not as a governor, but as a bishop. And what he meant by that was, don't go up to Milan as simply one to keep order by force, but as one to take an interest in the welfare of the people. But the governor spoke more truly than he dreamed. Because after Ambrose had been in Milan a comparatively short time, and had, by his excellent administration and by his fine character and his general attitude, had made people think very highly of him, the time came when the bishop of Milan died. And the people, the Christians of Milan, gathered to elect a new bishop. And this was a very important city, and it was an important office, and there were some of them who had one man they were very anxious to have, and some men, those people who had another they were very anxious to have. And there were occasions in those days when it came to actual fighting over the election of a bishop. And so, in any such occasion, it was thought desirable to have the troops at hand in order to establish order in case of disorder. And so Ambrose himself went personally to the meeting and had his troops there, and was present simply as an officer of the law. But the people, somebody spoke for this man, for bishop, and pointed out his good points, and someone else got up and pointed up his bad points, and told who they liked, and somebody else pointed up his bad points, and there didn't seem to be anyone that more than a fourth of them could agree on. And then it seemed somebody, nobody knows who, perhaps it was a child. Anyway, there was a voice said, make Ambrose bishop. And all the people looked up at the governor standing there, and they passed from person to person, my, isn't that a wonderful idea? Why didn't we think of that earlier? Think what a Bishop Ambrose would be. And so they all cried out unanimously, Ambrose, you must be our bishop. You must be the Bishop of Milan. Well, Ambrose was quite overcome with it. He said, he finally, when they were so insistent, he said, all right, he said, I will. But he said, give me a month for meditation and prayer and study of the scripture before I start on the work. So he did. He resigned his governorship. And for the next period of several years, he was the great Bishop of Milan, who had a tremendous influence all through the western part of the Roman world. The time came once later when a Roman emperor, a good Christian man, a man who had done much for the cause of Christ, but a man who was a good organizer, a powerful fighter, a man who had faced very difficult situations, had a city, the city of Antioch, in fact, had torn down the statues of the emperor and his family, and had there been a terrible upheaval there, and he'd lost his head and had sent in the troops, and they had killed a great many of them. And when he came to Milan, he was going to take communion in the service, at the church, and the men were lined up, coming up for the communion, and Ambrose saw the emperor back there, and he went back, and he said, "Emperor," he said, "you've got blood on your hands. You can't take the meal until it's washed off." And the emperor recognized the truth of what Ambrose said and the greatness of the character of this great Christian man, and he repented of his error that he had fallen into in his heat of wrath over what had happened, and even as David did before Nathan, he repented and was grateful to Ambrose. This shows you something of the character and influence of Ambrose. We must say some more about him later. But he was strongly in favor of the Nicene Creed, which was not a difficult thing ordinarily to be in the West, because most of the time, even after the accession of Valens, Valens was in control of the East. In the West, the emperors were, most of them, favorable. There's a period of succession of emperors there we're not going into, but they were in general favorable to the Orthodox Creed in the West. But Ambrose exerted an influence through the empire. He was a great administrator. He was one who faced some pretty difficult situations and faced them very bravely and carried them through successfully. He also was much interested in music, and he developed special services for the church in Milan, some of which are observed to this day in Milan, even though nowhere else in the world. But the name of Ambrose continues to this day to be greatly honored in the city of Milan. Now, we just mentioned the emperor. Number 8 is the accession of Theodosius. The accession of Theodosius. There, during the years from 365 to 378, Valens was ruling in the east. But in the west, there were two or three different rulers. We won't go into details of them. They're not tremendously important in church history. But when Valens faced the uprising and attack on the borders of the Goths in 378, and they defeated him and he was killed, and this was north of Romania, right in an area where they could spread out and destroy both the eastern section and the western section of the empire. There was a very serious situation. And the emperor in the west knew he was not personally capable of handling such a serious crisis. But there was a man who had been an enemy of his, who was living in retirement with his very able son, the two of them, living in retirement in Spain. And the emperor of the West felt that this man was the man who could handle the crisis. And so he sent to Spain and asked Theodosius to take over the rule of the East. And Theodosius, the Theodosius, an earnest Christian, an Orthodox Christian, a man who probably had much more Christian understanding than Constantine had, but a man who, like Constantine, was primarily a man in the political and military sphere, went to the East, took charge of the situation, made peace with the Goths, made certain concessions to them, and established things in sufficient order that the empire was not now overrun by the Goths and the other Germanic tribes from the north. This did not happen for another 50 years or so. It was 100 years from this time, Europe was sunk into the Dark Ages. It probably would have come 50 or more years earlier than it did if it were not for the ability of Theodosius. But Theodosius was an earnest supporter of the Nicene Creed. And now he was in charge in the Eastern Empire in 379. Who knows? If it had not been for the work of Athanasius and of Basil and the two Gregories and these others, who knows? But Theodosius, when he got things organized and settled and order established, might have tried by force to establish the Orthodox view as Valens Constantius had been trying to establish the Arian view. But he did not have a situation such as they faced. The work of these men had reached the thinking people throughout the empire to a very large extent. Arianism had been intellectually demolished, and it had been proven that the people of great Christian character, of Christian standards, of zeal for Christian accomplishment, with one notable exception, were not Arian, but held to the Nicene Creed. And so, while Theodosius did exert his power very strongly for the establishment of Orthodoxy, and he did not maintain Constantine's policy of toleration, but interfered much more than he had, yet it was not Theodosius' power, but the influence of these great men that really put an end to Arianism. And Theodosius only made a fact, made legally so, that which already had in fact become so. So Theodosius was not a great factor, but he put the capstone on the end of it, and we'll have to look at that in connection with the First Council of Constantinople next Tuesday.